So 5 on 5, 5 on RAID.RTE.ie. Our next guests are Eva Foreman and Neil Arthur, and they're here to tell us the story of their daughter, Nora. Good afternoon to you both.
Afternoon.
Yeah. So you had twins, Nora and Dahi. What year?
They were born in 2019, May right. 2019. Yeah.
And did you know the twins were coming? You obviously did.
Well, I mean, yeah, at a certain point. I remember that scan and she said, I can see two heartbeats. And I turned to Neil and I said, that's twins. And he said, I know that, Eva, yeah.
But you were the doctor.
Yeah. It didn't take a doctor to figure that one out, but yeah.
The expert opinion.
Yes, yeah.
And are there twins in the family, either of your families?
Yeah, I mean, I've cousins that are twins, yeah. And aunts and uncles, or grand aunts and uncles that are twins, right. And my cousins have twins, so there probably is there somewhere, but I didn't admit that to Eva, probably.
Yeah.
You know, early on. And was it an okay pregnancy for you?
Yeah,
Eva?
It was totally fine. Yeah. We flew through it, really, didn't we? Mm. And they arrived on time.
Well, they arrived, they were due for a section.
That's
on
right.
9 o'clock on Monday morning, and at 3 o'clock in the night, Sunday night, Eva went into labour, so we had to go in for an emergency section at 4 in the morning. So they were
a dramatic start to things.
Dramatic entrance.
Yeah. And you're a doctor, Eva.
Yeah.
I'm always curious about doctors and pregnancy and any sort of medical issue. Is it a good thing or a bad thing? That you know, you have more knowledge than the rest of us.
I'd probably let Neil answer that question. it's probably a mix, isn't it?
Well, I think we've talked about it a few times because obviously what came afterwards, you know, and I think we always found that the sample of kids that Eva sees tends to be sick. So you would nearly always skew towards this could be this, whereas if you're
worst case scenario kind of thing.
Yeah, maybe, if you're floating along nearly in blissful ignorance with your new baby and they get a bit of a cold or they have a bit of a puke, or you kind of just move on, whereas you're aware of all the things it could be.
Yeah,
and
maybe,
makes it a little bit more difficult to put.
But I think you also feel this pressure when you're a medical person, and if you're sick yourself or pregnant, you know, which isn't a sickness, but you don't want to be bothering people, and you kind of think, oh, I won't, you know, I'll tell them everything is fine, even if I've terrible pain or whatever,
until
you know.
Until it really isn't.
Yeah.
So Dahi and Nora, very traditional names.
Yeah, Nora, we had the name from early on. I think my aunt Spur mentioned it once and I just really, we loved it, didn't we? And then Dahi, like, they're not family names or anything. We just...
Well, my dad claims it's a family name, but a very distant cousin on his side.
Nora or Guy?
Nora.
Nora. Yeah. So Nora.
That's right. There are Noras on your side. Yeah. But we just came to them. We had a few names on the list, but they were the minute they were born, they were clearly a Nora and a Dahi.
And what was the dynamic like between the two of them?
So Nora was quite a big personality, and Dahi's quite a, like, he listed his favourite things yesterday, and quiet time was one of them, you know.
Peace and quiet, right? Yeah. How do you spell peace?
He's six.
And Nora would have been the opposite, and would have been, loved a bit of divilment, a bit of very social kind of child, and you know, he would be trying to play with his Lego in peace, and she'd come over and sit on the Lego and, you know, hand him something that he had no interest in, or she would, you know, shout at them, and you know, she would, you know, but they were very good with each other. You know, they both thought the other one was the funniest person in the world.
Yeah.
Like, they really did.
She went out of her way to wind him up.
Oh, and get him in trouble. Yeah,
like she, you know, I remember one time we were on holidays, and we were downstairs, but we could hear them upstairs, and I could hear her saying to him, sing a song, Dahi, sing a song. And he said, no, Mammy will give out. We're supposed to be asleep. And she was like, no, sing a song. She was trying to get him to be the one to get in trouble, you know. But that was her with everyone, wasn't it? And,
And another time we came running in because she was crying on the ground. And, you know, we went in, what happened? And he pushed me and we're like, Dahi, what happened? And he's 3 at the time, so he's not able to tell a lie, and he's like, she just lied on the ground and started crying.
Yeah, which you'd well believe him, you know.
So when was the first sign that there was something amiss?
Well, it kind of happened very suddenly for us. She started vomiting overnight one night. We assumed it was food poisoning, or I had cooked prawns the night before, and I thought my dodgy cooking, which wouldn't be the first time that happened, but or she just had a vomiting bug and I had just gone back to work. And so I went into work and Neil stayed at home with her and sort of, you know, put her on the bed beside him. He was working from home and she was just vomiting, not even a huge amount, I don't know. And I went into work and he sent me a photograph of her at lunchtime lying on the towel. And just something in the picture, I don't know, an instinct, I just immediately went home. And I suppose that's where the advantage of maybe being a doctor came in, that I could feel the soft spot on her head was bulging. And I knew straight away then there was something really terribly wrong. But I mean, you know, it was so quick, like less than a night of symptoms.
And what age
was
she?
She was 11 months.
Right.
Yeah.
The week before her first birthday, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a couple of weeks before, I think, at that, you know, when she was actually diagnosed. It was the 13th, wasn't it, of May, and the birthday was the 27th. And
which hospital?
We went straight to Temple Street. Yeah. It's our nearer hospital, but I also, I suppose, knew if it's the brain, Temple Street, you know, if it's a neurosurgery kind of thing, Temple Street's where we needed to go. And like, I remember the minder was there. We just said, just stay with Dahi, we'll call you when we can. I just knew there was something really terribly wrong. And we went into Temple Street and then it was the beginning of COVID then. So only one of us could go in. So I went in and obviously the staff in there also immediately knew there was something very wrong with her. And she went straight for a CT scan. And you know, I've been on the other side of that so many times, of like a child comes in, they're sick and there's a scan and there's something on the scan and I could read the room, you know, I knew what was, I could see it happening in front of my eyes. I could see.
You know the body language.
I knew the body language. I knew I could see that, you know, the doctor was going to show his consultant the scan and they look at me and I saw it happening before it happened nearly. And they came over, there's something on the scan and then the surgeons came down and, you know, she needed a drain put in that day because her brain was under pressure and there was a growth there and they were going to do a kind of more detailed scan, an MRI scan when they put in the drain. So, I mean, you know, we probably went into Temple Street about 2 p.m. that day and by midnight she had had emergency surgery. She'd had the scan and that's when they took, again, I was still on my own at that stage. They took me into a room to show me the scan and, you know, it was like lit up like a Christmas tree. There was just cancer everywhere.
Oh, right.
A tumour had spread everywhere.
All right.
At that point. So within 12 hours.
That's yeah. Because on that occasion, too much knowledge was a really bad thing for you because you knew exactly the extent of it.
Yeah. And I knew it was very visual looking at the scan. You could see it. And, you know, the funny thing is, in my job, I look at brain scans a lot. But I never looked at another scan of hers after that day. I didn't want to see them. I think maybe it was part of the denial, maybe, that if I saw it, I couldn't deny how awful it was. And that was the only time I ever looked at her scan. I never looked at it again. So, because I knew how bad it was, I guess. Yeah.
How do you negotiate that? Yeah. Well, what happens in the brain? Like, because any sort of logic, I suppose, leaves, isn't
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you rang me, I think, and put the guy on, the consultant on speaker, and you kind of talked it through. And, you know, we had kind of been back and forth on text, and I think we probably knew what was coming, but even hearing it said, I just remember.
I don't think we could have anticipated how bad it was, though. No. Even the
And I think once it was said, it went from a, this is something that is happening, to no, this is happening, and you know, I think it felt like the world kind of collapsed in.
It was a panic, like a panic, like what do I do now? Literally, what do I do now? Where do we go? What does, you know. I don't know, just a sheer panic.
Yeah.
Was there any, why us? Is that a reaction? No, it doesn't happen like that, does it?
Why us thing, I find, sorry.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, maybe your initial reaction might be, but I think we both kind of came to the realisation that, and it's probably the only way personally I could in any way deal with it, was it never feels like there's somebody sitting up there handing out, you get some good news now, you get some bad news. And So it's not a YOs, it's just a pure horrible bad luck situation. Yeah. And I think if we had gone down the road of YOs, and it's so tempting because it's so much easier and you can to something be angry. To blame, and it's anger and all that negativity, but I just, we didn't have the luxury of the time to be angry. Yeah. You know, we had to kind of accept where we were, what we were dealing with, which, you know, wasn't good.
Okay. You know. But I think anger is a legitimate response to all that. And I think a lot of people do respond to that with anger, and that anger might come out directed at a specific person or whatever. And I think that that's understandable. But, you know, isn't it, is it C.S. Lewis, I think, said, I sat with my anger long enough for her to tell me her real name was grief, you know, and
yes,
and it is, it's a grief. But I think, you know, that question of why us, it brings up two things for me, because I think why us? Yes, this has happened to us. But to me, it happened to her more than it happened to us. She's the one who didn't get to live her life, you know, and yes, it happened to us without a doubt. Our lives are utterly changed forever, but she suffered more than we did, you know. But I also think if you're saying why us, I think now we have this appreciation for life and for all that we do have. And I think unless you're stopping to say why us, why do we have these two gorgeous, healthy boys and jobs we love and friends and family around us? And, you know, if you're not saying why us for the good things, you can't really say it for the bad things as well. Yeah.
Sort of Buddhist outlook on life.
Maybe.
Yeah, we both went a bit philosophical.
Whatever works, Nick,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah.
So you were saying there was surgery, but then there was it was cancer, so there's the option of chemo. And that's the route that was taken, was it?
That's right, yeah. And like I think from the beginning, the oncologist, the oncology, the cancer stuff is all done over in Crumlin. So the oncologist actually came over to Temple Street to talk to us, because I think even from the start, it was whether we should or shouldn't even do that. That's how bad the cancer was. But I think the decision was fairly unanimous with us and them that we did want to try.
Well, we had the conversation, but the conversation we had was very much around, we don't want our grief to be put off because of where this is probably going to by making her suffer. So, you know, if putting her through chemo was going to give her an extra 3 months, but they were not going to be good quality, then it was going to hurt for us either way. And we didn't want to make her hurt to delay that because, well, I don't think we could have lived with ourselves afterwards, you know.
And Eva, you were in a position to ask pertinent questions.
Yeah.
And what were those questions?
I think that meeting, the first meeting over in Temple Street. Yeah, I was in a position to ask pertinent questions, but the area I work in is very different to oncology. And really, I didn't know.
Okay.
I didn't have much, you know, like, you know, we asked, I suppose, the practical questions. What does it actually look like going into hospital, you know? And it involved putting in a permanent line into her. She ended up with a feeding tube. She lost her hair, all those things, you know. How bad was the vomiting going to be? Those kind of things. I suppose at that point we weren't, I know nowadays with chemotherapy and with cancer treatment, a lot of the time it's living with cancer, isn't it? And, you know, the long term side effects are what you're worried about. I don't think we even allowed ourselves to ask about those things because we probably knew somewhere in our minds we weren't going to need to worry about long term side effects. But to be fair, they went through all that with us and the pros and cons of doing the chemotherapy. I do remember saying, I don't know if it was that meeting or another one. And I remember him saying, you know, she's going to spend a lot of time in hospital with this. And I remember just saying, well, time with Nora is time with Nora. And if she's well in the hospital, then that's OK. You know, we're there with her. It doesn't matter where you are, you know. And we made our own fun in the hospital, I think, during those chemo sessions. But yeah.
So she's only a year old.
Yeah.
Isn't that frustrating as well? On top of everything else, you can't communicate really to a 1 year old.
Yeah.
And could she communicate to you about pain?
I mean, she could communicate. All right. She wasn't short on that.
I don't know, and like we've talked about it, because you talk about all these things, I suppose, and in many ways, it was like, it was better than it happening when she was 3 or 4, because once, when she was getting the treatment and she was feeling nauseous or whatever, she was, you know, nauseous and sick and, you know, unwell. But once she was feeling well again, she maybe she didn't have the capacity, but she just didn't go back to that wallowing. Like, you could nearly, you could nearly tell the minute the pain medication and the anti-nausea medication kind of balanced perfectly, and she'd sit up in the bed and she'd be shouting at the nurses going by, and she'd be trying to get people to come in to play with her, and, you know, nearly immediately, you know, it could be in, over the course of an hour. So
maybe she was a little Buddhist herself, wasn't she? Really, she lived in the moment, you know, like, you know.
And there came a time then when you decided that, you know, the chemo, we want to stop the chemo.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think, like, people ask us, was that a, you know, a difficult decision? Which obviously it was an impossible decision, but at that point the chemo was really strong. She was really, really sick. She was needing blood transfusions nearly every day. She was vomiting, I'd say, 20 times a day. It was really hard to see her that sick, knowing it was the chemotherapy doing that to her. And then every time we did a scan, there was more and more cancer. So it's like, it wasn't working. It was making her miserable. It was making her sick. And I think that was the point we came back to Neil's initial comment of, we don't want to prolong her suffering to delay our grief. And even though when we stopped, which was in September 2020, thinking that she would only have months to live, we still felt that that was the right decision at that time. And, you know, people listening might think, well, I wouldn't give up on my child like that. And it's hard to express how much we would have done absolutely anything, you know.
Of course, yeah.
We would have done anything, but that was...
But you saw when the chemo stopped,
yeah,
that her quality of life improved.
Oh my God, yeah, hugely.
Yeah.
And of course, in true Nora style, even though that was September 2020 and, you know, I mean, the hospice were out in our house that day, we came home, it was end of life, where she's dying. You know, she lived for another 2 years. So, like, she did things on her own terms, you know.
Sort of 2 year act of defiance.
Yeah, 100%. And I mean, it was, I mean, every time they did a scan, then it was stable. And they're like, I don't know.
Right.
Keep going.
And what about that four letter word, hope, then?
When, yeah.
What did that sort of come in and trick you?
Yeah. I mean, I think, like, you know where you are. And I mean, Dr. Owens was very, was very clear, you know, and that's, we really appreciated that. It was very clear what we were trying to do here. We're trying to manage symptoms and, as Eva said, live with cancer, not try to beat it or whatever way you describe it. So a large part of your brain knew what this was and what you were going to. But there was times in the middle of the night at 2 in the morning when you're lying awake and, you know, you're looking up what treatments are where, and, you know, maybe there's a bit of hope here or there's a bit of hope there. And I don't think that was a bad thing. Sometimes people are like, you know, the hope is what, you know, what kills you. It's, I think you need that, because even, you know, her quality of life was great and, you know, there was lots of things. It was still hard, and it was still hard to keep going. And, you know, every kind of scan that went by with no development was a little bit more hope and a little bit more. And, you know, it did make it a little bit harder, maybe short term if you got a setback or whatever. But, you know, I don't think it really hurts to have that little bit there.
And nobody can possibly understand what you went through unless they went through it themselves. And that's where you got support, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
It's a very small club.
It's very, very small, yes.
Nobody wants to be in it.
No.
But it's very tight. People are there to help, aren't they?
For sure, yeah. And I think a lot of people who go through what we've been through try to find ways to honour their child in their work and in their life for the rest of their life. And I think we strongly relate to that. You want to keep your child's memory alive. And I think a lot of the cancer charities come from that. Avian's Pink Tie and
Laura Lynn.
Oscar's Kids.
All named after
children. Yeah. Dead children. And that's it. Yeah. That's it, I think. And like you say, it's a very small club that absolutely nobody wants to be in. But I mean, you know, we've our little 3 month old baby there. And, you know, people say when you have a baby, there's no manual that comes with it. Well, there's certainly no manual when you lose a child. But, you know, people who have gone before you. So I think in our case, you know, a lot of support, certainly after Nora died, came from Laura Lynn and Oscar's kids. Laura Lynn probably on the bigger picture stuff, the bereavement stuff and all that. But Oscar's kids, like Yav and Lara, are, you know, just incredible. And they lost their Oscar to a brain tumour as well. And they're just, you can WhatsApp them, you can call them, you know, you meet them for a walk. Like, they're there for those really practical, like, how is this day for you? Mm. Like, how was the last hour? Mm. Make sure you're drinking enough water, you know, the things, because you're just...
Because we spoke to Yav and Lara, and they said they're broken. That's, yeah. You know, it breaks you.
It does.
Yeah.
You're a different person and you live in a different world, I think.
Yeah. And after. It's as you say, a club, and it is a club. Like, I mean, the amount of people that you would never know. You never know what's happening, and all through the journey, and it is a journey afterwards. There was examples of that, of people just going that little bit extra, and I mean, you're never going to remember them all, and I know those people don't expect you to, but every single one of them makes a difference, and every single one of them makes it. And I mean, you know, I think you got great support from Lauren and Yam. And I mean, I got bereavement counselling with Laura Lynn, with Breffni, and you know, it's all those different people that are, you know, really trying to make a difference to people that are going through. I don't know if it's the worst thing that people could go through, but
one of the worst things. Yeah.
I do think it is. Yeah. I think it's hard to it's hard to imagine anything else. Like, I lost my dad many years ago, and obviously that was very, very hard time and difficult. But this, like,
I think it was
another level, you know.
I think it was you that talked about it before, as you know, your life is a rainbow. And all
yeah,
the
well, this was Rob Delaney, you know,
yeah,
the comedian, yeah.
So,
he lost it.
He lost a child, Henry, yes.
And the book is really, really powerful. But his thing was that your life is a rainbow, and people that have lost a child now have one more colour, so they have black in their, you know, and you know, it touches everything. And you know, when Dahi starts the first day of school, you know, that's a hard day. It's a lovely day because he is so excited, and you know, and every birthday, because they're twins, is a hard day. And you know,
it's because you talk to people who've lost children about their child's contemporaries, you know, so they'd see them first day at school, inter, junior cert, leaving cert, going to college, all that sort of thing. But they might be chance encounters in the supermarket. But you have Dahi there.
Dahi, so everything he does, she should be there.
And this is a sort of difficult question to answer, I suppose, because that colours your relationship with Dahi.
Yeah.
Is that something that you deal with, say, in grief counselling? It's quite specific, isn't it?
It is. I had grief counselling as well from a brilliant social worker in the hospice, St. Francis Hospice. And like, I think what, and actually the hospice were very good with this, of helping us how to deal with Dahi. But I think we've always had the policy of speaking openly with him about everything, and he sees us crying, and he talks about Nora. We talk about her every day in our house. I mean, we were just saying he's just started in senior infants, and he's his new teacher, and you know, he's in an Irish school and they're doing their news, and I'd say whatever, she picks a different child every day for their news. But he only told me yesterday, but he stood up last week for the news, and his news was, my sister died. You know, I'd say the poor teacher really fell off.
We shouldn't laugh. But you know what? That's
the way it is. Yeah. That's the way it is. We do laugh.
And it isn't, like, for him, he isn't saying that as a, this is terrible, no, upsetting. That's part of who I am.
Yeah.
And I think he wants people to know.
Yes.
Yeah. He wanted his new teacher to know.
Yeah.
And in many ways, we're so lucky because, you know, one of the big things is I found is that she's not, she doesn't become pictures on your phone. She become, like, she isn't just those static things. She was a person, and she was a full person. And, you know, it's always difficult to imagine how she'd grow, but having him as a counterpoint, you know, you knew how she engaged with him, and you can see what he'd be doing, and it's a little bit easier to picture how she would be engaging with the dog rather than, you know, so it's having him there does, I mean, it's, he's a great support to the pest. He's a very affectionate and loving child. And I mean, I think, you know, one of the things that kept us going was
him
and, and his routine, and he had to be here. So, because grief is exhausting, and you didn't have time to sit down and sleep. You
but just sure, I remember that, like, the day after the funeral, and we woke up, the three of us in our house, and we still had a 3-year-old who wanted his breakfast and to go to the park. I think we went to the park that day because, you know, it was just like, life goes on.
And as well as the horrific, horrific, unimaginable grief, it brings, I would imagine, this nearly crippling uncertainty into your world. Because, you know, you had twins.
Yeah.
We imagine how things are going to work out for them. And then cancer comes in and like a wrecking ball. So you have little Cunnell now, three months old.
That's right.
So there must have been chats around having another child. And how did they go?
Well, we'd always probably planned to have another child, and it was probably earlier than, you know, than Cunnell has arrived. I think you were...
It would have been chaos to have a baby in the middle of all Nora's treatment and everything. And then we were too grief-stricken to even think about that, I think, for a couple of years. But it was still a big decision.
It was a huge decision. And I think, you know, once we made it, we and like once we kind of, and I think we're quite good at that as a couple, is kind of once you make the decision and we're making it with the best of intentions and with whatever information we have, then that's the decision made. And, you know, I mean, it's not without, you know, it's not without triggering things. You know, Cunnell had a cough and was awake overnight, and I must have asked you about 15 times, but do you think he's okay?
Yeah.
You know,
that's the uncertainty, isn't it?
Yeah. And every, I think every pregnancy, every child to us feels like a roll of the dice, and we've rolled that dice and we've, you know, not got, you know, like, everything that happened to us, you feel like, are you tempting fate to have another one? But
without doing the numbers thing, like, Nora's illness is a very rare genetic disease, and I don't know, like, it's what's the de novo, like, it happened randomly in her, and the fact that it happened, it's a very rare thing that happened randomly in her, didn't happen in Dahi, you know. It's just
You mentioned that a lot of people who go through what you went through then direct their grief into charity work. And that's not something you're doing so far, but you would like people to know about the charities that helped you.
For sure.
Yeah.
I think, we're not, I don't think we're starting our own charity anytime soon.
No, we try fundraisers. So we did, it when Nora was still alive. She was still sick, and we actually have great photos of what we did. It was COVID, and we did a lot of sea swims, and, you know, we raised
Dipper
some
for the Nippers, it was called,
We raised some money for a few different charities.
That was Aileen's Pink Tie and Laura Lane and CHI, Children's Health Ireland,
But I think we're probably not at the stage where we're, I think, emotionally able to do that yet. So we try to do things to, you know, we have an annual run for Nora to, and it's as much about the awareness of the charities, because, you know, someone like Oscar's Kids is, you know, they're very small but very focused sort of charity that do really great work. And, you know, that's kind of why, you know, it's obviously difficult for us talking about this in a public setting, you know, but you do it because you want people to know about the great work that these people do. You know, they really do. Life is like, I remember when we got, you know, confirmation that Nora was probably only kind of weeks away, the guys were trying to get us to Lapland, you know, you know, on the next flight.
There was nothing that they wouldn't have done. Nothing.
Yeah.
And it started as we were going to go and visit a farm because she loved animals. And then, you know, I just remember texting, I think it was Yav, and saying, like, we're not, she's not, well, we can't leave the house anymore. She, you know, and she was like, leave it with me. and an hour later there was going to be a farm coming to our house. You know, it was there's nothing that they can't.
What came to your house?
Literally a farm. Literally a farm. Oh my God. Goat and sheep.
Chickens?
Chickens, rabbits, pigs. Right. Pigs in our living room. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. We say they're great. I don't know how. But anyway, no.
They're supposed to be very clean animals.
Yeah.
That's what they say.
But Nora, oh my God, she loved it. A pig in her living room.
Yeah, it's the funniest thing she'd ever
seen. Yeah, it was.
You have video footage of that.
Oh, we do, yeah.
Oh, you
yeah.
see, there you go. That's
and I actually think that was, I mean, that was, she was, at that point, she was paralysed. You know, we had to hold the animals up to her face. She couldn't move her hands anymore. And I think that was probably her last happy day, actually. Yeah. With the Santi, Make-A-Wish brought the Santi all the way from the North Pole to our house in November.
And that's his busy time. And
that's his busy time. Yeah. But he came. Yeah. Those 2 days that week were her last kind of.
She died in on the 18th of November, 2022.
Yeah.
Well, I think people know of the brilliant work that these charities do, but they also need to be reminded because a lot of them depend on donations to stay afloat. A lot of them don't get any funding from the government. So we're going to put a list of the various charities that you mentioned to us alongside this on the website.
Great.
Thanks very much.
And, well, you did Nora proud today, keeping her memory alive.
Yeah.
Thanks, Eva.
Thanks,
Neil.
Thanks for having us.
So much. Yeah. Very good.